Okay, let's read God's word in Mark chapter 12 and in verse 13. Later they sent some of the Pharisees and Herodians to Jesus to catch him in his words. They came to him and said, "Teacher, we know you're a man of integrity. You aren't swayed by men, because you pay no attention to who they are, but you teach the way of God in accordance with the truth. Is it right to pay taxes to Caesar or not? Should we pay or shouldn't we?" But Jesus knew their hypocrisy. "Why are you trying to trap me?" he asked. "Bring me a denarius and let me look at it." They brought the coin, and he asked them, "Whose portrait is this, and whose inscription?" "Caesar's," they replied. Then Jesus said to them, "Give to Caesar what is Caesar's, and to God what is God's." And they were amazed at him. And God will bless his truth to our hearts in Jesus' name. Religion and politics are a volatile mix. The world is full of ayatollahs, not least of all, of course, in this country. I remember being struck the first time I ever heard Paul Brady's song, "The Island," by these words: "Witch doctors praying for a mighty showdown. No way our holy flag is going to fall." And it's true the world over that politics and religion are often mixed, often with tragic consequences for people and for countries. And when it comes to mixing the Christian faith with politics, isn't that particularly ridiculous? Because wasn't Jesus apolitical? John chapter 18, verse 36, Jesus is on trial. He's just been flogged. He's a wreck of a human being at this stage. And he's brought back in before Pilate, who questions him further. And Jesus says nothing. And Pilate says to him, "You're refusing to speak to me? Don't you realize where it is you are and to whom it is you're speaking?" And Jesus said this: "My kingdom is not of this world. If it were, my servants would fight to prevent my arrest by the Jews." My kingdom is not of this world. So that means, doesn't it, that Jesus was apolitical. He didn't have a particular position. He wasn't concerned or worried. He had another kingdom to be bothered about. The kingdoms of this world were not part of what he came to be involved with. And at first sight, Jesus seems to confirm that when he responds to a question about a clash of kingdoms, which comes up in that passage we just read from Mark chapter 12. Is it right to pay taxes to Caesar or not? Should we pay or shouldn't we? That was the question that he was asked. Now, of course, as we know from the passage, it was a trick question. It says at the beginning of the verses we read, later they sent some of the Pharisees and Herodians to Jesus to catch him in his words. They came to him and said, "Teacher, we know you are a man of integrity." What we realize here is that they came to Jesus with a trick question dressed up in flattery. You know, flattery will get you everywhere. And so if you say nice things about people and lull them into a sense of acceptance, then they'll say almost anything. They'll bare their heart and soul to you. What, of course, was actually happening here was that Jesus was being judged. If you've been in religious company in your life, you may have had this experience too. It is sadly all too much a reality in religious life that you can be amongst people and they can be engaging you in conversation and asking you questions, but actually they don't want answers to the questions. The questions aren't real questions, they're trick questions. What they're actually doing is judging you. And they want you to expose to them what they've already decided about you anyway, which is that you are in some sense either unsound or totally lost. If you've been around church for a while, you'll have had that experience. I had that experience this Sunday morning. I preached for this church 8 years ago. Two people asked me questions in the porch that weren't questions for information. They were a form of judgment. And that's what was happening to Jesus here, and it may well have happened to you. And even if the text hadn't told us that the question was a trick question, we could kind of work that out for ourselves anyway because of the people who were doing the asking. Pharisees and Herodians. If you know anything about the society in which Jesus lived, you will know that Pharisees and Herodians despised each other. They were two totally different answers to the question of how the Jews could get their country back. The Pharisees' answer to that question is, God will never give us our country back until we become a righteous people. We need to sort out our religious behavior issues. We need to start keeping the law. We need to start doing all the things that the Old Testament says. And if we become a righteous people, God will give it back to us and chase the Romans away. The Herodians' answer to the question was not a religious answer. It was a political answer. They said, actually, this guy called Herod who understands us, he may not be entirely Jewish, but he's close. And the Romans have given him some power and authority. We should cultivate friendship with Herod and we should build Herod's kingdom, because that way we'll get the Romans out eventually. Two totally different answers to the same question. And they hated each other. But to both of their aspirations, to the religious aspirations of the Pharisees and the political aspirations of the Herodians, Jesus Christ was a threat that needed to be neutralized. And so they banded themselves together, people who normally couldn't bear to be in the same room with one another. They banded themselves together to see if they could find a way to rid themselves of Jesus. And politics and religion might be the way to do it. If they could get Jesus to say something that would either cause those who followed him to realize that he wasn't who they thought he was and abandon him and leave him, or on the other hand, if they could get him to say something that would cause the Roman authorities to be up in arms about him, then they would deal with him. Either way, they won. Jesus lost. So that's why they came with this question. Should we pay taxes to Caesar? Should we or shouldn't we? They did the thing that radio and TV interviewers usually do. They normally don't have any success in it, but basically what they said was to Jesus, we want a yes or no answer, you know, straightforward. Should we or shouldn't we? It's either yes or no. Don't fudge it. Don't give us someone else. Just tell us. Actually, they didn't succeed any better than William Crawley does or any of the others when you see what happened next, because in response to their question, Jesus asked for a coin. Why? Did he not know what coins look like? Could he not just have said, you know, when you get a coin, there's a head on the coin? Why did he ask for the coin? Well, the first reason why he asked for the coin was because when they produced the coin, it exposes what they are actually all about. It exposes their hypocrisy. Why? Because actually, in circulation in Jesus' day in Judea, there were two sets of Roman coinage. There was this Roman coinage, which was minted in silver, and it had the emperor's head on the back of it, and an inscription which was offensive to Jews because it proclaimed the emperor as God. And because Rome, when it conquered a country, tried as far as possible to accommodate itself to the views of local people without any kind of derogation of its power and sovereignty, they always tried to come up with other ways of doing things. So in the case of the Jews, they minted another coinage, which was not in silver but in bronze. And that coinage had no head of Caesar on it and no imperial inscription. So that was kind of an interesting thing. And the idea, therefore, was the Jews could use, without any offense to them, the bronze coinage and avoid the silver coinage. But when Jesus asked them to produce a denarius, which one did he get? The silver coin. These hypocrites were quite prepared to pay in Caesar's currency, whilst at the same time using this question to seek to undermine Jesus' authority. So he exposes them for what they really are. They've been carrying the silver coinage anyway. Not only so, but he asks for the coin so that he can confront them with two real questions, which are the questions I believe he confronts us with today in the 21st century, in this week leading up to Easter. We are confronted with these questions. Questions are these: how important are life's choices? Everyday choices that you and I make, how important are those things? And secondly, how important is Jesus? First question Jesus wanted to pose was this one: how important are life's choices? When you first hear what Jesus said here, it seems so simple. Then Jesus said to them, "Give to Caesar what is Caesar's, and to God what is God's." Now, when you hear that, it seems so simple to understand, doesn't it? It's a bit like if you live in two jurisdictions. You say, well, how can you do that? Well, actually, if you were a farmer in parts of Derry or Donegal, and some people that we know through family are in this position, they actually own land on both sides of the border. Because the border is an arbitrary line just drawn on a map, and it divides all sorts of things, including some people's farms. And so they farm on two different sides of the border. There are two different laws, there are two different standards, two different approaches to agriculture and all the rest of it, and they have to cope with those two realities. And when their animals are on one side of the border, they have to behave in a certain way, and when they're on the other side of the border, they have to behave in another way. That is living under two jurisdictions. And isn't that what Jesus is saying here? All you have to do is to pay to each jurisdiction what is due. So if you're keeping cattle in Donegal, then it has to conform to the laws of there. If it's in Derry, it has to conform to the UK laws. And the same thing here, you know, you give to Caesar what is his, and you give to God what is his. Of course, it's not that simple. Caesar's image on the coin, the silver coin, demonstrates that some things belong to him. And it's really interesting that Jesus does not deny earthly authority. At any point in his ministry, does he deny earthly authority? He made himself a subject to it. He allowed Pontius Pilate to declare him guilty and to crucify him. He was subject all through his days to the earthly authorities that ruled over him, and he never denied them at any point in time. And in his statement, he reminds everybody about the fact that Caesar's head on the coin shows that he has a sovereignty, he has power and authority in this world, and he has authority over us. But when he said that we should give to Caesar what is Caesar's and to God what is God's, it's not a simple distinction because, of course, everything belongs to God. The earth is the Lord's, and everything in it, the world and all who live in it. And this extends not only to property, but also to authority and power. Not only is it true that God physically owns everything that exists because he made it and belongs to him, he is the creator of the ends of the earth to a billion galaxies in space. All those things are his, and therefore everything that we have and everything that we are belongs to him. But not just that. Not only is it that he owns everything, but he has authority and power over everything. Jesus is before Pilate, and Pilate comes to him with a question. We talked a moment ago about that exchange between Jesus and Pilate. In John's Gospel, when that same exchange is recorded, in John chapter 19 and verse 11, in response to Pilate, when he says, "Why are you not speaking to me? Don't you know that I have power over you?" Jesus said, "You would have no power over me if it were not given to you from above. Therefore, the one who handed me over to you is guilty of a greater sin." Caesar, through Pilate, claims his earthly power. He said, "You've got to talk to me. You have to respond to me. I am your judge. I have power over your life." And Jesus said, "No, you don't. You have no power except for the power that my Father gave you. Because everything is his." So what does that mean? What that means, men and women and young people, is this, that there is no simple division of arenas in life. There is no sacred realm and secular realm, you know? And when you're in the secular realm, you behave one way, and when you're in the sacred realm, you behave the other way. Isn't that part of the reason why often Christians are accused of being hypocrites? Because they're one thing in church on a Sunday and someone totally different in the office during the week? What we're learning here is that there are no two realms, two different arenas in life in which we can behave differently because we are subject to different authorities. And everything in life's okay as long as we don't break the law of the land. No. No. Because the earth is the Lord's and everything in it, there is no division. But even more than that, perhaps most fundamentally of all, every earthly claim made upon our lives comes into tension with the ultimate claims of God. Family. We may be married. We will be someone's child. We may have children ourselves and extended family circles to whom we owe debts of love. Yet sometimes those claims upon our lives come into tension with the claims God has upon our life. There is no simple distinction between the two. There is not one area of our lives that just belongs to our family. And we don't need to worry about the claims of God in that area. Even that area belongs to God. It's the same in work. Our employer has certain claims upon our lives. He or she can demand that we are there to fulfill our hours and to carry out the purposes for which we were employed in the first place. And while we're there, that's okay. All I need to worry about is satisfying my employer. No. At times, the claims of that employer upon my life will come into tension and conflict with the claims of God upon my life. Government. The claims of government upon my life can come into tension with the claims of the Father. And self, because the biggest claim in my life is not my family, nor my work, nor the government that rules my country, but the biggest claim in my life is me, what I want, my priorities, my concerns. Even that comes into conflict and tension with the claims of God upon my life. It's kind of a poignant thing happens in Mark chapter 12. If you go home today and read the whole chapter, you discover that before this bit we read, Jesus is in contention with one group of people. Then the Herodians and the Pharisees come to him, and then after that some teachers of the law come to him. And there are various kind of conflicts going on. All of these conflicts are about refusing to accept the claims of God expressed to them through the life of Jesus. And then you come to the end of the chapter. You know how the chapter ends, Mark 12? Chapter ends in the temple courts with a woman, an impoverished woman, coming in to make an offering of worship to God. And she throws two tiny coins into the plate. They were probably copper coins. They would not have been a silver denarius. She hadn't seen a silver denarius for as long as she could remember. She came out with two tiny copper coins and she cast them in the plate. And Jesus said she gave more than everybody else who gave. Why? Because he said she gave everything she had. No doubt there were other claims on those two small coins. There might have been children to feed. There might have been bills to pay. There might have been the need to keep a little bit in her purse for an emergency she could not foresee coming. But at that moment of time in her life, the claim of God upon her life was such that she cast into the plate everything she had. You know, becoming a Christian does not add a religious element to our lives. Becoming a Christian is everything. Absolutely everything. Our family, our work, our country, ourselves, all becomes God's. I don't know about you, but that drives me to prayer. Because one of the problems in life is constantly trying to sort out these issues in the ordinary mundane decisions every day. Because that's the point here. You know how important are life's choices? Every choice we make is important. Because every choice we make is a choice in which we either make ourselves subject to the demands and concerns of the Lord who loves us, or we don't. And that's really difficult to do, you know. And I find that if I don't ask God about it, I get myself in trouble. I make bad decisions. I make big mistakes. And do you know what the reality is? There are leaders sitting in this church this morning, Christian leaders of this congregation. And they can't remember when they last prayed. Do you know how I know that? You might say to me, how can you say that? It's a terrible thing to say. How can you know that? I can know that because I've been in that position myself. When life has been so hectic and there has been so much to do, and there's so many demands and tensions upon your life from other people, you just don't take the time. You think you can wing it. You know you can get by. Now, Christian leaders sitting in this church this morning, and that's the reality in your life. You can't remember the last time you actually spent enough time in God's presence to ask Him what He wants you to do with your life. I stand here every Sunday and I say to people, I-56 is open for 24 hours of prayer every weekend. And you know what, guys? The same people sign up every single week. I don't have any problem getting the spot I want because nobody else wants it. Now, it could well be that you're spending that time praying in your home and you've set aside time in your life and you're disciplined about this. And I know there are people here who fall into that category, but my guess is that most of you are like me. You don't. And I've found, and this is just me, okay, maybe it's only me and it'll never be true for you, but for me, I've found since we opened that house of prayer, since we started the prayer room in this church, an amazing thing happened in my life. I find now I'm desperate to get there. I can't wait for it. I find that every time I go, God meets me. And He doesn't always tell me what I want to hear. Sometimes He tells me things I really don't want to hear. But I find that every time I go, He meets me. And because I go, I make better decisions. I'm much clearer in my own mind and heart about what God wants me to do with my life. Just because I take that 1 hour. I try to get in there every day now, if I can. Take an hour. I'm not telling you that so that you might think that's amazing and think I'm really holy, because if you know me, you know I'm not. I'm telling it to you because if it works for me, it might work for you. How important are life's choices? They are everything if you're a Christian. You need to be asking God. We need to be a church of people who are constantly asking God, what do you want us to do? But the second question Jesus was asking was this: how important is Jesus? You see, the Pharisees and their hangers-on were very impressed at Jesus' answer. That's what it said. Then Jesus said to them, "Give to Caesar what is Caesar's and to God what is God's." And they were amazed at Him. Now this is quite something. This is quite something that they should say they were amazed at Him. Why? Because this conversation they were having with Jesus, they were only having it with Jesus because Jesus had offended them. Religious people are easily offended, and Jesus had offended them. How had He done that? Well, it says in Matthew chapter 12, in an earlier part of the passage, then they looked for a way to arrest Him because they knew He had spoken the parable of the tenants against them. Jesus told that parable. You know the parable of the guy had the vineyard and he went away and he leased it out to tenants. And at the end of the year, he sent his servants to pick up the income from the vineyard, and they beat the servants and carried on really badly with them. And so eventually he decided he'd send them his son because they would respect his son. They sent him his son. And they said, well, he's the heir. If we kill him, everything's ours. So they killed him. And they realized Jesus told the parable about them. And if you were in their shoes like them, you'd have been offended. Because they would have thought to themselves, how can He say that about us? We're not withholding anything from God. We're really religious about giving to God all the things that the law says we should give to God. In fact, not only is that true, but even Jesus Himself had remarked on it from time to time. For example, in Matthew chapter 23, in His list of woes to the scribes and Pharisees, Jesus says this: "Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites! You give a tenth of your spices, mint, dill, and cumin." And what's all that about? Well, those are really small things, you know. They're the kinds of things that every woman in this church will have in a cupboard in the kitchen someplace, you know, a container with some salt in it, you know, or pepper that you fill the little containers with, or all those small kinds of ordinary everyday items that you would have in your cupboard and you wouldn't think twice about it. And yet the Pharisees were so kind of concerned that they should give a tenth of everything to God, they even tithed these things. That's how serious they were. So even in small things they gave. And in Matthew chapter 5, Jesus says this: "For I tell you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, you will certainly not enter the kingdom of heaven." The hinge point of the parable that offended them so much was this. Matthew chapter 12, verse 6. It says, Jesus says, he, the vineyard owner, had one left to send, a son whom he loved. He sent him last of all, saying, they will respect my son. And God had said this about Jesus. On the day of his baptism, Matthew chapter 3 and verse 17, a voice from heaven said, this is my son whom I love. With him I am well pleased. See, what mattered was not whether they tithe mint and dill and cumin. What mattered was not that they were known in public for a righteousness which was according to the law, and as Paul could later say in his own testimony about his past life in respect of righteousness according to the law, faultless. Didn't matter. There was only one thing that mattered, and the one thing that mattered was this: what were they going to do about Jesus? That was the question. Because Jesus was the Father's Son. He was the one the Father loved. And the Father sends his Son into the world, like the vineyard owner in the parable. They will respect my Son. I was sitting at the... The issue here was, what would they do about Jesus? How would they respond to him? And what they do here is they say, well, we're amazed. Amazed that he gave this incredible answer. Is that what God wanted? Is that amazement? Is that what God wanted from them? Well, I kind of think that's a bit like, if you know the film Jurassic Park, you know in the film Jurassic Park, there's the guy who's the park ranger, the guy who's supposed to look after all these wild dinosaurs that are running about the park, shouldn't be running about the park. And on one occasion, they lose all the power, and they have to go, two of them have to go from one building to another building to switch the power back on. But unfortunately, the raptors have got out, and they're running around. And so the park ranger goes with the woman who's going to get the switch breakers and get the electricity all back on again. And they go through these kind of trees, you know. And he knows the raptors are there. He's an experienced park ranger. You know, he's hunted animals all his life. And he's there with the gun, and he's watching. And if you know that part of the film where he gets to the point where he tells her to run, and she starts to run, and he's looking around, and all of a sudden he realizes that he's been outwitted by the raptor, and it gets him. And just before he dies, in a rather unpleasant manner, he looks up over his rifle and he says, clever girl. He's talking about the raptor here, not the woman who was running, okay? Because she had outwitted him. Here was the great park ranger, the guy who had hunted animals all his life, and the raptor had got him. It's kind of sad end of the story. And it's kind of like, in a way, what these people were doing here about Jesus. You know, they were sort of saying, they were amazed at him. How can somebody like him come up with an incredible answer like that? You know, he got us that time. I mean, what are we supposed to say to that, you know? Top that one. That's kind of what they were saying. These people who were amazed at him would soon be crying for Jesus' crucifixion just a few days later. How can you say you respect God when you're busy plotting with other people to destroy the one and only Son whom he loves and whom he sent into the world? What kind of faith in God is that? I was sitting at the cruise Saturday a week ago. We were playing Uri. And Aaron Black's dad was sitting just a couple of seats in front of us. For those of you who know nothing about football, Aaron Black plays for the Crews. He's a class young player. And his dad was sitting like two rows in front of us. His dad's a Newry City supporter. And his son's playing for the Crews, who are playing Newry City on this occasion. Talk about divided loyalties. But anyway, he's sitting down there in the stand, you know. And it sort of struck me, what a terrible thing to do if you're the father of a footballer, to go to the stand on a Saturday afternoon while your son's playing on the pitch. You might hear some things you definitely do not want to hear. Because if the people sitting around you don't think your son's up to much, they're going to be shouting about it, and you're going to have to listen to this. And they probably don't even know who you are. Not a very pleasant prospect. And isn't that where God was? He sends his son into the world. What do you think of my son? And here were these religious people who claimed to know God and love God and follow God and who had a list of righteousness the length of your arm, and they're busy trying to put to death the only Son of God. You see, the image on the coin that day wasn't the only image that Jesus presented to the crowd. Because he also presented this one. The sun is the radiance of God's glory and the exact representation of his being. Our attitude to Jesus is everything. You get everything else right, you get this one thing wrong, you're in trouble. Because God sent his only Son into the world, you know, the exact image and likeness of the Father, in whom the Father's glory dwells in fullness. And he says to us, have a relationship with my Son. Our last Alpha course, we had a young man on the course who was an atheist when he came on the course. And as the course went on, got into conversation with him, one of the things he said was this. He said, this Christian faith thing's absurd, doesn't make any sense. How can you have a relationship with somebody you can't see, you can't talk to, you can't hear? What kind of a relationship would that be? And I guess a lot of us have that problem. You know, we start to think, well, how can I, this preacher keeps going on about a relationship with Jesus. How can I have a relationship with Jesus? He hasn't been in the world for 2,000 years. How on earth can I have a relationship with him? And so what do? Because we don't understand that bit or we don't get that bit, we settle for a formal duty of religious life. We turn up at church, we give some of our money, we volunteer to help in an organization, we get involved in good stuff. But all the time, if we were being really, really honest about it, there's a big black hole somewhere in the middle of our life which never got filled. And this religious thing we're involved in, it takes up a lot of our time, it gives very little satisfaction. We settle for formal duties when what the Father asks us is to receive his Son. And he gives us the Holy Spirit so that it's possible to do just that. How important is Jesus? Jesus is everything. And if you and I can't get to know him, and if we can't get to open our lives up to him, then we're lost. Because I don't know about you, but my righteousness doesn't exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees. It's a song we sometimes sing in church. And the verse goes like this about Jesus. Freely you gave it all for us, surrendered your life upon the cross. Great is the love poured out for all. This is our God. You know, the crucified man on the cross, this is our God. Lifted on high from death to life, forever our God is glorified. Servant and King, rescued the world. This is our God. And then the song invites you to do something. And I will fall at your feet. I will fall at your feet. And I will worship you here. I think that there are people in church this morning. Good people. Decent people. Religious people. And you need to do this right now. You need to accept the fact that what really matters in life is not all the stuff you might do, but whether or not you know Jesus, whether or not you're prepared to receive the Father's gift. Where would you have stood that day? Would you have been with the religious leaders of Israel, claiming to know God and to serve God and yet plotting to destroy God's Son? Or would you have been falling at his feet in humble faith and receiving whatever it is that he came all that way to give?